Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, you know, Limbaugh said it in a very articulate fashion. Here it is.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And George W. Bush tried. In fact, back in, I think it was 77, 78, when he was running for the House of Representatives, unsuccessfully from the state of Texas, the cornerstone of his campaign was privatizing Social Security. John McCain now is come out in favor of privatizing Social Security. Joe Lieberman, a couple days ago, saying, no, he's really not in favor of that. Look at his website. And then McCain, in an interview with the New York Times yesterday, saying, well, actually, I'll correct any policy paper that I've put out that might intimate the personal savings account are not a very important factor. In other words, he is in favor of privatizing Social Security. And, in fact, he's contradicting his own website, strangely enough. So let's have a conversation about this. This, I think, is going to become one of the most important issues in the campaign. Frankly, I think it already is. It's just that nobody's talking about it because everybody's talking about, the polling numbers for Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And really, we need to be focusing on some of these real issues here. Terry Jeffrey is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com. Regular, you'll see him on, you know, many of the TV talk shows and whatnot. And CNSNews.com, I used to call you guys a conservative news site. You say what, Terry?
Well, we report straight news, but I can tell you I am a conservative.
Okay.
No doubt about that. But yeah. We're not a commentary organization. We're a news organization.
Yeah. So, speaking for yourself, then, as CNS News, here we have the Social Security program. This is put into place by Franklin Roosevelt without a single vote from Republicans passing the thing. Republicans have on a number of occasions tried to take it down unsuccessfully. And now actually the insurance companies are whacking it. And that's a whole other thing. But the insurance companies are forcing you and me, if we get injured on the job and disabled and can't go back to work, they're forcing us to apply for Social Security. And if we get turned down, they're forcing us to reapply before they will take our claims.
Mm-hmm.
And this is costing the Social Security Administration an average of about $4,700 per person for these claims, most of which are not valid, most of which the insurance companies actually should pay for. But it causes the insurance companies to have an additional 258 to 512 days where they're not paying you and me and everybody else. And so they're making literally hundreds of millions of dollars in profits on hitting Social Security like this.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a piece of this whole thing. I mean, it seems like there is this organized campaign to destroy Social Security, which has never failed to pay a check. Its overheads of Social Security is 1-2% at the very most. It's these nice, boring, green eye shade guys writing the checks and doing the actuarial stuff. I like this.
Right. Well, I'll tell you something, just quickly, two problems with Social Security. One is fiscal. David Walker, until very recently, was the Comptroller General of the United States, ran the Government Accountability Office, I think, an excellent public servant, did a very good job of defining the fiscal jeopardy the United States is in because of the major entitlement programs, especially Medicare and Social Security.
He was on this show last week talking about this.
Okay, well then, you know the gentleman and you know his argument.
I do.
So do your listeners. But so I'll just say, he has calculated that there's almost $500,000 in unfunded liabilities for every single household in the United States sitting out there, and we're talking about tens of trillions of dollars in the lifetimes of our children that the current tax structure can't pay to cover Medicare and Social Security. That's one side of the problem.
But let me put a punctuation point on that. If right now the first 90-some-odd thousand dollars of your income is taxed for Social Security.
Right.
If you make $1 million a year, you only pay Social Security tax in the first $98,000, and the next $902,000 you make, you don't pay a penny of Social Security tax on.
Yeah,
and
sure.
So if we simply eliminated the cap, and I encourage you to go ask David Walker about this, if you eliminate the cap, that $44 trillion deficit that he's seen when you look out into the future for Social Security and Medicare goes away.
Well, and look, I'm not going to deny that raising taxes isn't one way to deal with this, but also
this is creating a flat tax.
Also, if you look at David Walker's studies, the GAO studies, right now we have a government a federal government that eats up about 20% of the gross domestic product. One in every $5 of generated wealth in the United States every year. His estimate is that will go up to 40% of GDP. So if you're going to raise taxes to keep the current Social Security Medicare system, you're talking about doubling just the federal tax burden on the American people. But the second problem I see with these entitlements is government dependency. So for me, the ideal solution would be, how can we make sure that people are taken care of for their health and their income needs and their retirement without bankrupting the country and without making them dependent on the government? Is there a solution to that? I think there is.
We have the Social Security program. One-third of all the payments that Social Security makes are actually for literally widows and orphans,
right,
and disabled people. They're for people who, you know, a friend of mine, Michael Hutchison in Santa Fe, you know, fell and broke his neck. He's in a wheelchair. He can't, you know, not even a wheelchair. I mean, he's paralyzed from the neck down. And he's living on Social Security. That's a third of the total Social Security payments. The remaining two-thirds is old age poverty insurance. I mean, it really is an insurance program. Everybody participates in this insurance program.
Right.
I don't get it. I mean, there's nothing about Social Security that says you can't save for your retirement. And I just don't get it, why you would want to do it, why you consider that dependence on the government.
Well, it is, because it's not guaranteed to you. And if Congress tomorrow, you talk about people wanting to eliminate Social Security, if they wanted to, they could abolish your Social Security check tomorrow.
Not a chance. They wouldn't survive the political firestorm.
Well, you're
the reality is that we want this. We Americans want this system.
Well, I agree with you on that, Tom. They're not going to eliminate it entirely, but what they may, in fact, do is tax you for your entire life. And right now, the payroll taxes are 15% of your income. You're right, up to the first $98,000. I bet
half of that is paid by the employer.
Almost every single person listening to the show probably makes under $98,000. There are some listening, I'm sure, who make more. But most of your audience makes less, because most of Americans make less. So all of their income is taxed. And yes, half of it is paid by the employer, but it is, in fact, your income. It's just paid directly to the government by your employer. But here's the thing. Is it equitable to tax someone their entire life that way and then reduce the benefit you've been promising to them or increase their taxes? Or could we go to a system like Congressman Ryan and Senator Sununu, I believe, have offered legislation that is a perfect solution. People can opt in to paying up to 6 points of that tax into a personal savings account, and they are guaranteed the same Social Security benefit they get now, even if they get injured.
We already have personal savings accounts. They're called IRAs. They're called SEPs. They're called 401Ks. I mean, we already have this stuff, number one. And number two, if we did away, you said the other choice is cutting benefits or raising taxes. And if you simply did away with a cap and made it a flat tax so that Bill Gates is paying the same percentage of his income that I'm paying and that you're paying and that all of our listeners are paying, if Bill Gates is paying the same percentage of his income, all these problems go away.
What's
wrong with a flat tax? I mean, Steve Forbes and everybody are running around going, flat tax, flat tax. Let's make a flat tax for Social Security.
I don't believe they all go away, but let me look at it. Let me present it a different way. As two different options and an opportunity. The Ryan Sununu plan, which, by the way, has been scored by the actuaries of the Social Security Administration. People can go online to the Social Security Administration website and read how they scored it. It would, in fact, make Social Security solvent. What they say is, okay, if you want to stay in the current Social Security system, that's fine. You got it. You're guaranteed.
But then you're creating an optional program. Then you're creating basically a welfare program, and they're easiest to destroy. This is incremental destruction of the Social Security system.
But,
you know, in Argentina and Great Britain privatized their Social Security systems. They're now, people in those two countries, they both crashed and burned. And people in those two countries are now paying as much as 30% of their total payments in fees to banks and investment houses that are holding their funds. The government, you're paying 1.5 to 2%.
Wait a minute. Let me give your listeners what Sununu offers them. They could take 6 points of the money the government's taxing away from them, put them in a group of broad-based mutual funds over the course of their life, and when they retire, they get the income from that. They purchase an annuity that gives them the income. And if they die, that income goes to their children. They're up to that guarantees up to the Social Security.
If you want that to happen, get a 401k.
Any of the money over that, they get to keep and do whatever they want with. And secondly, Tom, if you're making $40,000 a year and the government's already taken 15% of your income, and you're saying go out and get a 401k, why can't you take that 6% the government's taxing and save it for yourself?
Because it'll destroy the Social Security system.
No, it won't.
All right. Well, people can read about. All about it, CNSNews.com. Terry Jeffrey. Terry, thanks for being
Thank
with
you,
us.
Tom.
Good talking to you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
The Tom Hartman Program.
It's history, and what will take its place will be a prime example, truly ample, opportunity. Oh, there's a hefty deductible on all the drugs you need. And there's co-payments for sure, we're selling a cure if you're feeding our greed, oh, Grandma. Sign the paper, Grandpa. Don't be slow, yes. You'll get medication. If you join our HMO, there's no more Medicare. You'll just have to trust us while we're making Medicare go. We'll give your health a scare.
Yeah, we're going to make Medicare go away. We're going to make Social Security go. This is what they're... The Wall Street Journal. Today's Wall Street Journal. In a wide-ranging interview last week, Senator McCain offered the most detailed account to date of his thinking on economic issues. Now, first of all, this is what Joe Lieberman had to say about John McCain on Social Security.
John McCain is not for the private accounts to take the place of Social Security. He's for what Bill Clinton used to call Social Security Plus.
Yeah, right. Well, this is the Wall Street Journal on Social Security, who interviewed John McCain. And they say on Social Security, the Arizona senator says he still backs a system of private retirement accounts.
John McCain is not for the private accounts.
On Social Security, again, the Wall Street Journal, the Arizona senator says he still backs a system of private retirement accounts that President Bush pushed unsuccessfully and disowned details of a Social Security proposal on his own campaign's website. So his website is apparently lying to us. And McCain says he's going to fix it. A centerpiece, in fact, the Wall Street Journal goes on, a centerpiece of a McCain presidential bid in 2000 was a plan to divert a portion of Social Security payroll taxes to fund private accounts, much as President Bush proposed unsuccessfully. Under the plan, workers could manage the money in stocks and bonds themselves. Oh, just what we all want to be doing, right? Panicking every time the stock market drops. Senator McCain's 2008 presidential campaign website takes a different view, proposing supplementing the existing full Social Security system with personally managed accounts. But as noted, he has disavowed his own campaign website. Now, this is, first of all, this is McCain doing the conservative thing, doing the, you know, as Limbaugh points
out. Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
This is rolling back the New Deal. It's nothing less than rolling back the New Deal. Let's keep in mind, too, the amount of money that goes through Social Security is enormous. It is so large. The amount of money that goes through Social Security, it is so large that if all that money was shifted into Wall Street, it could almost equal all of the private investment in Wall Street. It wouldn't be 100%, but it would be awful close. And it would be more than all the investment of people making less than $100,000 in Wall Street. It would be a massive boon. It would be billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in commissions for brokers and Wall Street banks. There is so much money to be made. At the same time, this is not going to be sold this way. McCain is not going to go out there on the David Letterman show, for example, and say, yeah, I'm here to tell you that we're going to do away with Social Security and you're on your own. If you got enough money to set it aside, great. If you don't, tough. He's not going to say that. Instead, he's going to be nice and funny. It's going to be Ronald Reagan revisited. For example, Here he is on David Letterman. I believe this was last night.
You know who I like is that John McCain. He looks like the guy at the...
Let me set this up. First of all, David Letterman takes a pot shot at John McCain, makes his jokes about him, and they're pretty funny. Then McCain fires back on the Letterman show. And, you know, obviously the writers put this thing together.
You know who I like is that John McCain. He looks like the guy at the hardware store who makes the keys. He looks like the guy who can't stop talking about how well his tomatoes are doing. There, that. He looks like the guy who goes into town for turpentine. He looks like the guy who's always got wiry hair growing out of new places. He looks like the guy who points out the spots they missed at the car wash.
So then they bring John McCain on, and John McCain fires back, again, scripted by somebody. Probably David Letterman's writers.
You think that stuff's pretty funny, don't you? Well, you look like a guy whose laptop would be seized by the authorities.
What?
You look like a guy caught smuggling reptiles in his pants.
This is pretty funny stuff.
I'm not going to have him try it.
You look like the guy who the neighbors later say he mostly kept to himself.
I mean, this is how John McCain is going to campaign, and always has. You know, as the nice guy, and people are not going to get that his policies are going to rip apart this country. They're going to continue the 30 years of Reaganomics and Reaganism that has largely destroyed the middle class. I mean, just absolutely whacked the middle class. Yesterday on Hardball, Chris Matthews played a clip where he was in the audience when Hillary Clinton gave a talk. And he asked her, he said, you know, this was in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania. And he said, you know, when I was a kid, if you graduated from high school and you had a good high school diploma, you could get a job and raise a family with a single income. Are those jobs going to come back? And she started talking about higher education. I want to share with you after this break just a very just short little piece about how those jobs actually can come back and why nobody's talking about it. And we'll take your calls at 866-303-2270. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. The red on the flag is our blood. See, I'm American too. In the hold of a ship, my ancestors came, torn from their homes and sold off as slaves. We built up this country at the end of a chain, and many have died for our rights. See, I'm American too. I dream of a time in the land of the free. We all belong and this country believes we can let go the distance between you and me. Oh, I'm American too. Yeah,
hey, we're all Americans here. American. That's the thing we need to remember. We're all American. We're all in this together. And that's the whole idea of Social Security. We're all in this together. Yes, to a certain extent, I am my brother's keeper. Yes, if each and every single one of us is going to face the risk of, for example, breaking our necks and being paralyzed for the rest of our lives, or having a child with severe birth defects, or losing our jobs and being absolutely flat out, if we're going to face those kind of, or, you know, old age with poverty, if we're going to face those kind of risks, then we're going to distribute those risks over a large number of people so that all of us have a smaller risk and all of us are protected. That's the basic principle of insurance, and that's what Social Security is. It's an insurance program. Pure and simple. and it needs to be preserved, in my opinion. It's an insurance program run by the largest nonprofit in the United States, which is the United States. And we want these things run by nonprofits. We want their first job to be to provide Social Security, not to make a profit for their stockholders. So anyhow, that's my rant on that. In terms of are the jobs coming back to Pennsylvania, it's real simple. We just need to start doing what China is doing right now, what Japan has been doing for 50 years, what South Korea has been doing. There's this new book out called Bad Actors. It really lays this stuff out. It's my BuzzFlash book of the month over at BuzzFlash.com. It is we need to say, which is, by the way, what we started in 1798, the first, or 1789, excuse me, the first law like this was passed. It was pushed through by Tench Cox, who was arguably the first lobbyist. He was not an elected member of Congress. He was a businessman. But he pushed this thing through that was a law for the protection of domestic manufacture in the United States. And what it said was, if you can make a pair of shoes in the United States with a dollar's worth of labor, if we all agree that there's a buck's worth of labor in a pair of shoes, and you want to make those shoes in Mexico where there's 50 cents worth of labor, you want to make them in China where there's 20 cents worth of labor, no problem, we can't stop you. But when you import them, when they hit the border, if they're coming from Mexico where it's 50 cents worth of labor, there's going to be a 50-cent tax on them, a 50-cent tariff, so it costs a dollar to bring them into the country altogether. So you're still paying that dollar, whether it's a labor cost or whether it's a tariff. And if it's coming from China where there's 20 cents worth of labor, there's an 80-cent tax. China is doing this right now. There's a 22% tariff if you want to import a car from the United States into China. On the other hand, if you want to bring a car from China to the United States, it's only a 2% tariff. We have gone nuts in this country by abandoning all this stuff during the Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush administrations. This is just a Ford administration thing. For 200 years, tariffs have built this country. In fact, the sole source of revenue that funded the federal government from the time of the Revolutionary War, from the time of the victory of the Revolutionary War, until the Civil War, 100% of all the salaries of every member of Congress, the president, the White House, the entire federal government budget, all of it, the Indian Wars, everything was paid for by tariffs. 100% of our budget. From the Civil War till World War I, tariffs accounted for 2/3 of the total federal budget. From World War I to World War II, when the size of government more than doubled, tariffs accounted for fully 1/3 of the federal budget. Tariffs are now a drop in the bucket. And the lack of tariffs is why our manufacturing jobs have gone overseas, and that's how we bring them back. We'll get into that in more detail on some other occasion. I wanted to stick with Social Security right now. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartmann.com or AirAmerica.com. On the Tom Hartmann page, there should be a link that links back to our live chat room. People hanging out in there. I hang out there during the breaks. Jeff in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
I wanted to mention, you were talking about Roosevelt. I called in yesterday as the ghost of Thomas Jefferson, and this relates very closely to that. Roosevelt was, an attempt was made on his life right before he took office in 1933. First time I heard about it was yesterday. I've taken many, many history classes. There's probably a reason for that. He knew who attempted his assassination, yeah. And it was a group that controls the finances of this country. And the only way that he could find to limit their power to bankrupt this country again, put us into another depression, spike, and hold the people as virtually as slaves, as Jefferson said they would, was to implement these New Deal programs and embed them deeply into our society. That kept money out of the central bank that they couldn't privatize and move up and down and hold us like they are right now.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about when you said an attempt to assassinate him was actually the overthrow, the coup that was planned, that General Smedley Butler blew the whistle on this thing. That was in 36, by the way. And Butler named names. You know, the Morgans were behind. I mean, there was a bunch of banking families and you know, the robber barons, basically. And they wanted the General Smedley Butler, who was kind of that General's Eisenhower. He was the most decorated Marine in history at the time. And they wanted him to lead a coup to overthrow Roosevelt. And he blew the whistle on it, published a book about it called War is a Racket, and came out about it. And there was a brief flurry of investigations. And then the Roosevelt administration decided that it would be better to just bury the thing rather than, make a big fuss about it. They didn't want anybody else to get the same idea. But you're absolutely right. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt took these guys on, and he took them on in a very, very serious way. He talked about the rise of a new kind of monarchy, a new royalty in the United States, and he was totally opposed to it.
The royalists I have spoken of, the royalists of economic order, have conceded that political freedom was the business of the government, but they have maintained that economic slavery was nobody's business.
And then he went on to say that overthrowing this kind of power is our duty.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power.
And that's what he did as
our allegiance. And our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
There you go. And it's time for somebody to be speaking like Franklin Roosevelt once again to these kinds of forces. Bob in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. You know, we need to make an investment income subject to Social Security tax. As you've pointed out many times, Bush lowered the capital gains tax rate down to a flat 15%.
Well, it's not even flat. It's actually graduated. If you only earn $20,000 or $30,000 on your dividends and investment income, you pay less than, you can pay like 6 or 7%. It's actually a graduated tax. But you're right. The maximum that you make, if you make your living sitting on your butt around the swimming pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, the maximum income tax you pay is 15%, and it's not subject to Social Security taxation.
And so we need to make that subject to the Social Security tax. And also, Tom, when you're talking to people like Mr. Jeffers, I noticed that David Walker was honest about this. They try to lump Medicare and Social Security in one ball of wax.
Right.
They're separate problems. Social Security is not the same magnitude of problem that Medicare is, but they want to lump them into one deal,
right,
and then brand them as one insolvable problem.
So that's right. And Medicare is largely a problem because of things like this Medicare Part D, the donut hole, and the government can't negotiate for drug prices, and because of, you know, Bill Frist's family. I mean, you know, it's just that you got all these billionaires who are making a fortune off the privatization of our medical system, and it's just incredibly destructive. Michael in Huntington Beach, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask, see if you could inform me about, I've heard that certain parts of Social Security are taken to help pay down some of the deficits every year. And I've tried to Google this information up, but I can't seem to find anything on it.
Yeah, the ultimate book on this, Michael, and thanks for raising the issue, the ultimate book on this is Ravi Batra's book, Greenspan's Fraud. And he points out that in 1983, in the second year of the Reagan administration, Reagan saw what was coming down the road was the baby boomer generation retiring. Well, actually, Reagan didn't see it, his economic advisors did. And said, you know, we got to do something about this. And so the only generation up until that point, from the creation of Social Security in 1935 up until 1983, the people who paid into Social Security, all of that money that same year was recycled into payments going back out to retirees. So every generation was paying for the retirement of their parents. Starting in 1983, they said, okay, we're going to set up a separate savings account, a trust fund, that will be where the baby boomer generation will not only pay for the retirement of their parents, but we're going to double tax them. And they literally doubled the tax on Social Security. We're going to double tax them, and the other half of that tax is going to go into a savings account so that the baby boomers are not only paying for the retirement of their parents, but they're also paying for their own retirement. And this one, by 2040, when the baby boomers are all dead, this trust fund will be exhausted and will go back to a pay-as-you-go system like we had before 1983. And that's the Social Security Trust Fund. And the Social Security Trust Fund invests its money. And it invests its money by buying treasuries, which is a fancy way of loaning money to the government. But, it buys treasuries. And therefore, it makes a return. There's interest coming in on that. So Bush comes along and he says, look at this. It's just worthless paper. It's just treasuries. It's just IOUs from the government. Well, it's only worthless if the government is worthless. And, you know, Bush is doing his best to make it worthless. But that's the situation. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
get by, one paycheck away from turn out the lights. If the kids don't get sick, we just might survive. Sometimes a good fight is hard. See, I'm American too. I'm out on the street and I sleep in the park. Since my hopes melted down into this shopping cart, my world's a place where living's an art. But I could still come back. See, I'm American too.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Hey, stick around, by the way, in our second hour. Sam Harris is going to come on and tell us how some people's religious beliefs are just so crazy you have to kill them. And in our third hour, Governor Jesse
Ventura. My problem with Senator McCain is he says we may have to stay in Iraq for 100 years if we have to. And I say no. I agree with Ron Paul. We marched in there. We can march out.
So Jesse Ventura is going to come by and have a conversation with us. Should be entertaining in the third hour of our program. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Adrian in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Adrian.
Hi. I wondered if you would make a comment on two provisions that became law under Reagan in 85. One is the government pension offset, and
right.
The other the windfall elimination provision for civil servants, teachers, police. That
right. These were both attempts by Reagan to reduce the total pool of participants in Social Security and thus weaken the Social Security system. I'm of the opinion that people who have the ability to waive Social Security and go into private pension programs should not have that ability, because Social Security isn't just a retirement program. A third of the payments are, as I said, widows, orphans, and disabled people. Is you know, it's an insurance program. And, you know, it's fine that people have private pensions, and I'm all in favor of that. And government employees and everybody else, they should have private pensions. But not instead of Social Security, along with Social Security. Does that address the issue you want raised, Adrian?
Yes, but in my mind, it was so unfair to civil servants, because
yep.
when they go to retire, their Social Security that was promised to them is cut in half or worse just because they chose to be a civil servant for part of their career.
That's right. And as I said, this was part of, and Robbie Botter covers this in his book, Greenspan's Fraud. I mean, this was the Greenspan Commission, right? You know, Greenspan and Moynihan and Reagan putting this thing together. And many of these policies were put into place during Reagan's time as ways to incrementally decrease Social Security. They were all about privatizing it. Adrian, thanks for the call, and thanks for raising the issue. Do appreciate it. Betty in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening to KTRC. Hey, Betty.
Hey, Tom, you already said it. I just wanted to remind people that the name of the Social Security program is the Old Age Survivors and Disability Insurance Program. And I think that's important that most people don't know that these days.
That's right. We should refer to it as OASDI rather than as Social Security. But, you know, you're right. Most people have no idea the genesis, the history of it, or even what it is. They don't realize it's actually an insurance program, not an investment program.
Right.
And,
thanks, Tom.
Yeah. Thank you, Betty. I appreciate the call. Great to hear from you. Jim in Berkeley, California, listening on KGRN. Hey, Jim.
Yeah, KKGN, Green 960. Hey, how you doing?
Wanted
to ask you back on the trade topic for a second. I think, and I'm not an economist, I'm actually a lawyer, but I think the free traders tend to rely theoretically on David Ricardo and his ideas of comparative advantage. So I wanted to just ask you to comment on that, why it's right or wrong, why it applies to today's situation or not, if you could.
Sure. Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage that he advanced in a series of papers between 1815 and 1828 or thereabouts, the most famous in 1816 and 1818, called On Labor and On Profits, was basically a variation on what Adam Smith wrote in the Wealth of Nations in 1776, which is that if the example, as I recall, that Smith used, and it's been 30 years since I read Wealth of Nations, and it's a dense read, but my recollection of his example was that if you had a country where it was easier to grow sheep, you know, to have sheep because of the terrain, and you could make great sweaters, and then you had another country where it was easier to grow to have cows, and you could make great milk and cheese, and you had another country where it was great to grow vines and grapes, and so you could have great wine, then all three countries would be, each one had a comparative advantage in those areas, and so all three countries would benefit if they all traded with each other. On the other hand, and Smith pointed this out, if two countries both could grow wine, or if two countries both had sheep or cows or whatever, then it is incumbent upon each of them to protect their domestic protection, their domestic production, particularly when those products are not merely things like, you know, wine or cheese, which arguably are luxuries, but when they're necessities, you know, staple foods, things that have to do with defense, the infrastructure of the country. And we've gone way beyond that. I mean, we can't make a cruise missile in the United States any longer without chips from China, a country, the only country, to the best of my knowledge, in the last 10 years that has actually threatened to throw nukes at us. And so it's David Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage is, frankly, I think, a poor way to defend what they call free trade, which is not free trade. And here's the main reason why. 50% of all international trade is not one company buying from another company. Actually 50% of it is, but the other 50% is within companies. In other words, you've got a company in the United States that used to make things in the United States. They set up a factory in China to make those things, and then they buy them from themselves in China and import them into the United States tariff-free. It used to be if they wanted to do that, they had to pay a tariff when they brought that stuff into the United States, so they wouldn't bother to make the factory in China. That's why we made shoes in the United States for 200 years. That's why we made shirts and jeans and everything and cars and everything else. And increasingly now, we're making these things overseas because it's this so-called free trade is actually merely facilitating the offshoring of jobs. And there, as Hillary Clinton pointed out yesterday, there are tax advantages to doing this, which is crazy. I mean, this is absolutely crazy. Another remnant of the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration. So, Jim, that's my take on that. I thank you for raising it, though. Norman, in Washington, D.C. Hey, Norman, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going? I think Democrats have already solved this problem, didn't we? Republicans just keep bringing it up, like the Confederate flag.
Yeah.
Just like you told that guy, you have to the cap. There can be no cap.
Yeah.
97,000. That's what Warren Buffett is paying on
Social Security. That's right.
I'll make that in 2 years.
I know. It's nuts, isn't it? Well, you know, Warren Buffett only pays Social Security income tax, and he thinks this is wrong, by the way.
Yeah,
he only pays Social Security income tax on the first 3 or 4 days of his income, and then after that, he pays none. And you and I pay it all the way through. Yeah, it's crazy. Norman, thanks a lot for the call. Coming up next, Sam Harris. Do we really have to kill some people just because of their religious beliefs? He thinks so. We'll talk about it. Stick around.
Helping you win the water cooler wars.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman.
So are radical atheists as dangerous as radical Christians or radical Muslims, as the Tim McVeighs of the world and as the Osama bin Ladens of the world? Is God real? Is religion real? Is it reasonable to kill people for their beliefs? Sam Harris believes so. Rather than my putting words in his mouth, Sam, welcome to the program. Hey, Sam.
Hi, Tom.
SamHarris.org, the website, his books, Letter to a Christian Nation and The End of Faith, New York Times bestsellers. Sam, you write that some propositions in The End of Faith, you write, some propositions are so dangerous that it may even be ethical to kill people for believing them. So
right. Now, let me point out that quote has been taken out of context so many times as to have its meaning.
I'll follow it with the following sentence. It says, this may seem an extraordinary claim, but it merely enumerates an ordinary fact about the world in which we live. Certain beliefs place their adherents beyond the reach of every peaceful means of persuasion while inspiring them to commit acts of extraordinary violence against others.
Right.
There is, in fact, no talking to some people. Would you place, for example, the Germans in World War II in that category?
Certainly some of them. Yeah, and when you ask yourself why it would have been ethical to have dropped a bomb on Hitler or to drop a bomb now on Osama bin Laden, wherever he's hiding in plain sight in Waziristan,
yeah.
It would be ethical not because they have killed so many people personally. I mean, to my knowledge, neither of them ever killed anyone. It would be ethical because of what they are plotting to do, what Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda presently are plotting to do, and what they're likely to be able to do if they're continually enjoy the freedom to plot.
But we're talking about a very small number of individuals here. I mean, it's like the German people. Once they woke up from the trance of Nazism, once the Japanese woke up from the trance of emperor worship and believing that the emperor was invincible and divine and everything, and they saw, you know, hey, ain't the case. They became like you and me again. I mean, they became rational people again, assuming that you and I are rational. Well, we can figure that out in a minute. But at what point, reading your book, and particularly reading your letter to a Christian nation, I mean, where you just get into this absolute black and white thinking. For example, so let's be honest with ourselves. In the fullness of time, one side is really going to win this argument. The other side is going to lose about whether or not, you know, religion is legitimate, essentially. You're painting with a single brush large swaths, I'd say probably, you know, half the world.
Well, actually, I have my black and white thinking applies to ideas, not to people. I mean, clearly people are able to change their minds, most of them, most of the time, although it often happens under duress. I'm talking about the difference between having good reasons for what you believe and having bad reasons. Now, this is a difference that we readily acknowledge in every area of our lives except when it comes time to talk about religion and God and the divine origin of holy books. And the thing we have to recognize is that are not demanding that people be reasonable about their religious beliefs and the moral order of their universe that they're going to erect on the basis of claims about divine books and invisible gods. We are paying an incredible price for this. We have essentially given cover to truly sociopathic behavior.
I don't disagree in the larger context. If you're looking at the Crusades, if you're looking at modern day fundamentalist Christianity and Islam that have produced things like Tim McVeigh blowing up the McMurrah building or Osama bin Laden, in that context, I don't disagree. But more broadly,
that comparison is to enthrall to some real political correctness and shoddy thinking. I mean, to compare Tim McVeigh, who was emblematic of almost nothing. I mean, there's really no trend in our society that we have to seriously worry about.
That's actually not true. The Christian identity movement in the United States is substantial. The survivalist movement is substantial.
Tim McVeigh read that. Substantial as Islam.
There are tens of thousands of guys running around with guns in the United States right now just waiting for, as McVeigh believed, after he read, I'm forgetting the title of the novel, you probably know, but he read this novel about, you know, the end days and how, you know, this guy blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City, in fact, and it led to a government crackdown, and then all the good white Christians rose up with their guns and killed off the Jews and the African Americans and the Mexicans and Hispanics and whatnot. I mean, that was McVeigh's belief, was that he was bringing about, you know, this great racial cleansing, and it was grounded in this fundamentalist Christianity, and not unlike Osama bin Laden's. I agree with you that those are sociopathic beliefs. But your rejection, I would say equally irrational, is your rejection of any concept of religion. You say it's absolutely black and white, it's all or nothing. Do you love anybody, Sam?
But, no. How is it equally irrational?
Well, I'm going to demonstrate that right now. Do you love anybody?
Of course. Are you going to ask me if I can prove whether I love somebody? Is this the
Certainly.
End for this argument?
Yeah, exactly.
It's absolutely a ridiculous analogy. First of all, you can prove that you love somebody. We know what we mean by love. We know the kinds of behaviors and facial expressions and words and deeds that issue.
And there's even a neurobiology associated with it, right?
And indeed,
arguably, it's a good survival instinct because it bonds people together and you know it ensures the survival of the species. I think we're in agreement on that. You're a neurobiologist.
Yes, and there's no question that we will one day understand love at the level of the brain in far more detail than we do now.
Well, I think we do to a large extent.
Well, and but there's no question that doesn't deflate the importance of love.
I mean, so what's wrong with experiencing love for creation as opposed to an individual? Because I would define my experience of the religious experience as in that context. I look out at the world and I see something that is entirely alive. I see something that is vibrating with intelligence. I see something that evokes in me a feeling that is just as strong as the feeling I get when I look at my wife or children who I love very much.
I think that is totally legitimate, and I share
that's
that.
The basis of religion.
It would be great if that were the basis of religion. It would be great if
that is the basis for most moderate religious people.
Well, then we have to look at closely at what people believe, what they claim to believe, and what they do on the basis of these beliefs. And it is quite clear that most people, most of the time, believe a lot more than that in the service of their religious ideas. They believe that one of their books was dictated by an omniscient and therefore infallible being. They
Some
believe
people.
that the book cannot be subjected to the ordinary types of criticism that we subject the rest of human literature to. And when you look at these books are filled not with beautiful elegies for nature and the mystery of the cosmos. These books are filled with reasons to kill your neighbor for thought crimes.
Well, they're filled with both.
Offenses.
Let's be honest. They're filled with both.
Not so much of the former and a lot of the latter.
Sure. Because by and large they're history books. And again, in your books, and I've read Letter to a Christian Nation, I've read good parts of the End of Faith, and you reject out of hand the possibility of people having a moderate position with regard to religion. That is not being religious fundamentalists. What you're describing are religious fundamentalists. I would submit to you being, I guess, I'm not sure, a Jewish Christian Buddhist, maybe. I don't know. My grandfather spelled Hartman with one N. The first language I learned was Yiddish. I was raised as a Methodist. I took refuge with the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala. I've seen it all. I mean, it just seems to me that in every religion that I've had contact with, the vast majority of the people, even people, I have good friends who are fundamentalists in several different religions, even they are ultimately religious moderates. The people that you're describing, these hyper fundamentalists, seem to me like a very small slice of the religious community. And well, not unlike this very small slice of the atheist community, like Mao Zedong and Joe Stalin, who justified the murder of a lot of people by, quote, rationality,
yeah,
end quote.
Another illegitimate comparison. First of all, I'm not denying the existence of moderates. And many, many millions of people are moderates, clearly. I think you are vastly overestimating the proportion of moderates in the Muslim world. And on any given question in the United States, if you ask people if they believe in evolution, or if they believe that Jesus is going to come back out of the sky and save the world with his magic powers, you get a majority of Americans believing preposterous
things. But they're not putting a gun in your face as a result of those beliefs.
They're electing presidents who think they can close their eyes and ask the creator of the universe whether to go to war.
Well, okay, I'll give you that George Bush is one of those sociopathic fundamentalists. I'll give you that. SamHarris.org. Yeah, is the website. Sam and his books, Letter to a Christian Nation and The End of Faith. Good talking with you, Sam. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Past the hour. How is it any different for a radical atheist to say that we should kill people because of their religion some people's religious beliefs are just so intense that there's no talking to them, therefore we have to kill them. How is that any different than Jerry Falwell saying this?
You got to kill the terrorists before the killing stops, and I'm for the president. Chase them all over the world. If it takes 10 years, blow them all away in the name of the Lord.
How is it any different? I would say, yes, radical Islam is growing. Yes, radical Islam is irrational. Yes, radical Islam does want to get us. And the reason it's growing, the reason it's irrational, the reason it wants to get us is because of the foreign policy of the Bush administration. It was a tiny, irrelevant, largely unnoticed sliver of Muslim thought before George Bush became president of the United States. And now you've got kids wearing Osama bin Laden T-shirts all over the world. That's our foreign policy. Steve in Wisconsin. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Steve.
Well, I think Sam was selling his position a little bit short, and the whole discussion got derailed into a direction that's not really the gist of what he's saying. I read his book, and I think the main point he's making is that we shouldn't have a double standard for, as a society, what we accept as knowledge. Because you can say that I feel that the universe is living. I feel that I have a soul which assures my personality survive my death. But you should have you should really prove that. I mean,
I can. And what I'm saying is that's no different than saying I feel like I love my wife. That these are, you know, that feelings are real things too, and that there is a biological basis for my loving my wife, and I believe that there's a biological basis for loving creation. I believe that the religious impulse, which is something that I'm prefacing this with I believe, but actually, you know, there's good science backing this up, that a significant majority of people have had in their lifetimes the experience of absolute mind-boggling transcendence. You know, Einstein talked about this. He talked about how...
Tom, I agree with you, but Einstein made a huge mistake in his life. He said, God does not play dice, and that's when he rejected quantum physics. So when people make...
But that had nothing to do with his comment that science without religion is blind and religion without science is lame. I mean, that was really the point that he was making.
Well, but you see, if you mix the two types of statements, that is, specific statements about the nature of reality, what Sam Harris is saying that religion has specific claims about the nature of reality. You see, in a moral argument, you can make a moral argument for behaving certain way because there is heaven or there is hell, okay? And there is a different morality attached to the belief that this is it.
I understand it, but see, the point that Harris is making, and he's not here to defend himself, and I'm a little uncomfortable saying, you know, representing his beliefs. So let's say that the point that evangelical atheists make is that evangelical religious folks, and I don't consider myself one of them, I consider myself religious and spiritual but not evangelical, but nonetheless, that evangelical religious folks say that morality comes from religion. I don't believe that. I don't think the majority of people who consider themselves religious believe that. I think that morality is just as biological as love. It is part of survival. It's wired into all of us. And you know, it's... You don't need religion to have morality, and he says that everybody who's religious believes that you have to. It's not true.
You're the most open-minded individual, and if all religious people were like you or all atheists would be just as open-minded as you are, we wouldn't have problems in this society. And I do reject some of the rhetoric that comes out of Sam Harris that you just pointed out, but I think there is a more fundamental issue here. That's what I wanted to point out, that this is not a debate about what exists out there or what it is out there, if there is a soul or there is not a soul. It's simply an argument about what we as a society can accept as a...
Well, sure, and that's and at that point you simply have laws. You say, no, you can't, you know, Tim McVeigh, you can't blow up the McMurray Building because you know, you read some novel and you think that this is going to bring about the return of Jesus. Or Alan Goldman, you can't go into the Dome of the Rock and murder a whole bunch of people because you think that that's going to bring about the Second Temple and Mashiach is going to return. That's at that point you just pass laws. But, you know, your point is well taken, and I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Kelly in Portland, Oregon on KPOJ. Hey, Kelly, what's up?
Hi, how are you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I hope you do.
Thank you.
No, I'm calling because of, geez, if you go back to 68 and the people who came into the administration back then, we have, like, Rumsfeld, we have Cheney, we have Pat Buchanan, And then on Sunday's news program, I heard Pat Buchanan when they asked him, what would Jesus do? And Pat Buchanan said, Jesus would kill people.
Yeah, I
cannot see how religiously he can say that when it's taught, thou shalt not kill, and do unto others as you would have them do unto you, not do unto others as they do to me.
Yeah, exactly. No, and this is how the Crusades were a perversion of Christianity, just as bin Laden is a perversion of Islam. I mean, it's just that simple. And rather than indicting all Christians for the Crusades or indicting all of Islam for bin Laden, what we need to do is we need to be reaching out to people and saying, you know, you're welcome to your religious beliefs, and there's certain behaviors, you know, blowing people up, we're not going to let you participate in. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's a full body alert!
Baby, take off your coat.
Uh-oh.
Real slow.
Real slow.
Baby, take off your shoes.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I'll take your shoes. Baby, take off your dress.
Uh-oh.
Yes, yes, yes.
We're going to be talking about Spitzer here again?
Can't leave your hat on.
Ah, yes, leave your hat on. Ah, it kind of made Spitzer look classy. The head of Formula One Racing, Max Mosley, is in hot water this week after allegedly getting caught on video participating in a Nazi-style orgy with five prostitutes. There was a concentration camp theme. It gets even freakier when you find out that Mosley's father, Sir Oswald, was the leader of the British Union of Fascists and a friend of Adolf Hitler. Downright strange. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for the web stream and all things about Air America and the Tom Hartman program, for that matter. William in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, William, what's up?
Not much, Tom. I think there's a difference between your arguments semantically. I think when you speak of religion, you speak of what he would call spirituality, and when he speaks of religion, he speaks of what you would call just institutionalized religion, which is to say religion more as a force of governance than a force of positive.
Yeah, to some extent, although Sam isn't here to defend himself. So rather than either one of us trying to represent his positions, let's just represent our own. The position I'm taking on this is that I believe that spirituality is an instinctive built-in thing for humans. I think it's part of our survival instinct. I think it's a positive force, net positive. I think it's been corrupted many times by political things that are called religions. But that religion, by and large, frankly, I believe has been a positive force. Yes, we can point to all the horrors foisted by religion, but I would say that there are probably far more that have been foisted in the name of, you know, getting resources and things.
Science has a lot to thank for religion, especially the early sort of saving of culture in times of great stress.
Well, on the other hand, you want to talk about science, talk about the eugenics movement.
Well,
I mean, you know, look at all the people who are killed in the name of science.
Yeah.
I mean, the American eugenics movement in the 20s was what Hitler based his eugenics movement and Nazism on in the 30s and 40s, in Germany.
Exactly, and it continues on today.
Yeah, and I would submit to you that there are atheists, a small subset, but there are atheists who are as evangelical as Jerry Falwell. And I hear from them every time I talk about this topic on the radio. And they say, no, atheism is not a religion. I would say for that small number of people, it actually is. There's an organized belief system. It is as equally, I will acknowledge, it is equally irrational as my belief system.
Yes.
And they're evangelical about it.
Yes, well, I think when somebody uses their spiritual, their beliefs as a force of governance or coercion, then it is sort of this, you know, like the early Crusades era church, that sort of thing.
Then it becomes toxic. Yeah, I agree. Well said, William. Then it becomes toxic. And this is the point, by the way, right after 9/11 happened. I was contacted by Rodale Press. They were putting together an instant book, you know, one of these instant books that come out right after an event. And it was published about a month after 9/11. It was called From the Ashes. And they wanted essays from a bunch of people who were involved in these kind of issues. And at the time I had, you know, I bought a dozen books in print, and several of them on spirituality and religion and things like that. So they asked me to submit a piece to it. The Dalai Lama wrote a piece for it. Pope John Paul II wrote a piece. Billy Graham wrote a piece. And then there were a bunch of people that like me that you probably hadn't heard of. It's still in print, actually. It's called From the Ashes, A Spiritual Response to 9/11. And in that piece that I wrote for that instant book for Rodale, I quoted from the history of the Crusades, one of the Crusaders who was talking about riding in blood and guts up to his harness reins or up to the middle of the calves of his horse. And I said, Judaism went through a period, you know, an 11th century period or pre-11th century period, and you can read about it in the book of Joshua, of violence, and Judaism became a modern-day religion. Christianity went through a period of 10th century mentality, you know, in the 10th century or in the 12th century, the Crusades, the 11th and 12th centuries. But it has become, by and large, a modern religion. Islam was in the process of becoming a modern religion. And to a large extent, we set it back. And Buddhism and Hinduism have both become, by and large, modern religions. Although in Hinduism, there's still a lot of, you know, men own their wives and they kill them for infidelity and things like that. A lot of 10th century mentality, and probably in some Buddhist states as well. But I don't know of any war that's ever been fought in the name of Buddha. So I guess that's one variation. But my point was that we need to help bring these religions into the 21st century, rather than bombing them and putting them back into the 10th century. And that's that reactivity that we have been, frankly, in my opinion, creating. And it ain't a good thing. Jim in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I just was thinking that I think that your definition of fundamentalist on both sides is incorrect. Because isn't a fundamentalist someone that adheres to the fundamentals? So if someone's not adhering to the fundamentals, then that basically eliminates them. So when you label Tim McVeigh a Christian, I mean, it's obvious that he's not a Christian. He never was a Christian.
But he believed himself to be one. And I would suggest to you that those people who call themselves fundamentalist Christians, who would then go out and say that, for example, you know, people should not be allowed to have gay relationships because, you know, in Deuteronomy, or in Leviticus, rather, it says that that's a bad thing. In the same place where it says that equally bad as eating shellfish, you know, they're picking and choosing from their religious books and it's wrong, in my opinion.
It doesn't matter what the person says. It's what the Bible says, particularly the New Testament. You can't say that the New Testament or Christianity and the whole shellfish thing, that was done away with. That was for Israel and Israel only. So,
well, then why do you have all these preachers running around saying we need to have a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage?
Because it should be with the states, and the states, basically, yeah. That's a congressional.
I think, Jim, you and I are in agreement on this, and I, you know, and your point is well made. Thank you for the call. Tim in Portland on KPOJ. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Tim. I mean, Tom. I think the biggest problem is that when we give human attributes and even an ego to some omnipotent singular entity, we can rationalize all kinds of wills and desires on that power and then act on that rather than – like you say you're a Christian, but I don't believe – you anthropomorphize that, the spirit of the universe.
Well, I do and I don't. You know, I mean, this morning, as every morning, before I, you know, after I get up and before I come into the radio station, I go out on my back deck and I pray and I look up at the sky and I pray and I do it frankly because it makes me feel good. You know, this is purely my thing, right? But I'm talking to somebody in my mind. I mean, there's somebody out there, or there's something out there that is hearing me, and I personalize it. You know,
but he's not giving you orders.
No, I haven't heard any orders recently.
Is there a difference between what God wants and what God's will is?
Well, I honestly don't know. I don't hold myself up like George Bush does as somebody who understands God's will for him and for his life.
Exactly, that's my point. Because if we humanize it and give God an ego, then God has desires. And if his desire is to go democratize Iraq, then I think that's the big problem.
That's where religion becomes toxic. No, excellent point. And frankly, that's where, you know, any belief system becomes toxic. Anthony in Seattle. Hey, Anthony.
Well, first of all, I'm not going to argue with you. I don't believe that atheism is a religion. But just going forward, I think that the people that came over, the Puritans or whatever, that came over to this country because they were fleeing from religious persecution, I think that's what the problem is that these people, they set up shop and then it gets so toxic. I just think we need to crack down. We need to get rid of all organized religion if it means, you know,
Good luck. I mean, that's like saying we're going to get rid of all marriage because there's some dysfunctional marriages. Religion is, I'm telling you, religion is something that is, it's in our genes. It's genetic. It's in our brains.
Religion is the opiate of the people. Religion is the opiate of the people. It is seductive. It's evil, and I think it needs to be destroyed.
So you're evangelizing against religion.
I think that,
and you're arguing for the destruction. Should we kill people who are religious, as Sam Harris suggests?
Well, it doesn't need to get to that point, but it certainly does need to get to the point to where we just kind of start cracking down on it.
See, I would say that you're engaging in an irrational fundamentalist position that is not dissimilar from that subscribed to by Tim McVeigh and Osama bin Laden.
Well, if I'm in their company, then more power to me.
I don't mean that as a personal slam, but what I'm saying is that it seems like that is a very fundamentalist position to do away with all religion. It's the other end of the spectrum of force your religion on everybody. So anyhow, thanks for the call though. I appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program here on Air America Radio. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day,
5 days a week.
Headline shout. Latest deeds from secret deals behind the scenes, where money's buying up the truth and power lives outside the rules. But some refuse temptation's dance and won't give in to circumstance, even if they have to go against the grain.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, an accredited White House reporter, let's see, congressional reporter, UN reporter. Wait, you've got a whole bunch of accreditations, don't you, Ellen?
I do. I'm actually on the Hill right now as we speak. Today, I mean, there are a lot more serious things, although some people might not consider this some people consider this very serious. This was a hearing today held between on the Endangered Species Act, of which Barbara Boxer is the chair. Senator James Inhofe is the ranking member. Boxer, and this had to do with the polar bear and putting that on the endangered list. Inhofe said, well, the Clinton administration took 250 days to rule on the Canadian lynx, but then it got interesting. Senator Boxer said, quoted the Bible and the the Bible talking about protecting God's creatures, then Senator Inhofe said, well, false gods should not be worshipped. You have to worship the Creator. And then Boxer said, liars should not have essentially a voice.
Whoa.
And
we're going to have, by the way, tomorrow's program, we're going to have Mark Morano on, who is on Inhofe's staff to debate this issue. So it should be interesting. So I'm sorry,
well,
I interrupted you.
We're going to put the sound from the audio from that up, but it was pretty intense today.
Wow.
The other issues that are going on is that the EPA, 16 state attorneys filed a suit against the EPA today, saying that the agency has failed to comply with Supreme Court ruling that carbon dioxide and other gases are pollutants under the Clean Air Act, and then ordered the agency to regulate them. And they want to compel the EPA to act within 60 days. And New York, Baltimore, as well as the District of Columbia, joined the 16 states.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting on that front.
You know, Ellen, on that issue, George Bush, when he campaigned in 2000, campaigned on the platform that carbon dioxide was a pollutant, should be regulated by the EPA, and there should be caps on it. And as soon as he became president, he eliminated that part of his agenda. He reversed himself on that. John McCain is taking the old 2000 George Bush position now, by and large, on this. A lot of us are looking at this very skeptically, thinking that John McCain is going to pull a George Bush if he were to become president. What are your thoughts? You know these guys.
I would say he will be under so much pressure to bend to the Republicans who elected him that I would agree with you 100%.
That he'll flip on it, yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Lots of other interesting news today. The president talked about Afghanistan, and he praised NATO today for acting in Afghanistan, and he has really sort of pushed that, and he's pushing the whole NATO alliance in Afghanistan, but then he also went and pushed for Romania and for other countries, and to really continue to get Croatia, Albania, Macedonia involved. And very interesting today, in one of the Hill publications, and actually I think it was in the Washington Post as well, the Greek government has said that Macedonia should not be called Macedonia because part of Greece is called Macedonia. And so there's a whole lot on that issue. It may seem like a small issue, but they're certainly trying to make that into international issue.
Well, that's an issue they've been fighting about for over 3,000 years.
Absolutely. Well, it's continuing in a full page ad in the Washington Post and several of the Hill publications. And Federal Chairman Bernanke today spoke to the Joint Economic Committee. He said the recession is a possibility. He also said that inflation has been a source of concern. He said the price index for personal consumption expenditures rose 3.4% over 12 months, up from 2.3% over the preceding 12-month period. He did not talk about whether the Fed was going to reduce interest rates. Obviously, he would say, well, you know, he doesn't know what they're doing, but he didn't mention that as a possibility.
Did he address the acquisition by the Fed of all these new powers that the administration is talking about giving that to them? Do you know?
He was asked about that in questions, and very honestly, I have to tell you, I wasn't there for that piece of it, so I don't know. We only actually stayed for the beginning, and it may have come up, but.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure.
I'll have to track it down in the papers tomorrow morning or this afternoon.
We'll probably even have it for you this afternoon. We just took off, and I mean, we were hearing about all these other crazy hearings going on that are going. Also,
yeah.
McCain has said today that he probably is not going to make his vice presidential announcement until the convention.
Oh, really?
Have some reason to go to the convention.
Now, is there a political calculus involved in this? I mean, is it a good thing or a bad thing to announce your vice presidential nominee, or whatever you want to call the word, your partner, I guess, before the convention? What historically has been done, and what's the conventional wisdom about the best way to do it?
Well, the conventional wisdom is that ever since conventions got to be less nominating and more of a crown.
Coronation,
you want to actually do it at the convention so that you have some news that's being made. But, you know, If the Democrats can decide who's going to be their VP before, I think the pressure on McCain to decide that will be enormous.
That's interesting. Although that would decrease the news value of the convention, though, wouldn't it? I mean, might that decrease the news coverage, or is it that the networks are all making so much money right now on the Democratic race, they're just loving all politics all the time, and they'll figure out a way to make the convention interesting, too. They'll figure out some way to gin up a fight.
Conventions can be very boring, as we know.
Yeah. Well, you and I will be at both of them. You and I will be at both of them. We'll be in Denver and we'll be in Minneapolis. I'm looking forward to it. I enjoyed traveling through Africa, through the Sudan and Kenya and Darfur with you, and I'm looking forward to... What is this, 4 years, 5 years now we've been doing these things?
Oh, we've been doing them a long time, Tom. And you know what? I can't wait to get you in Dubai.
Yeah, I'm looking forward. I would love to, Ellen. Let's talk about it. Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thank you. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, for your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity. Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back to Tom Hartman Radio Program right here on Air America Live, noon to 3 Eastern, 9 to noon Pacific Time, broadcasting live coast to coast 5 days a week. And Jesse Ventura is with us, the New York Times bestselling author and perhaps better known as the former governor of Minnesota. Jesse Ventura, Governor, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here today.
You have a new book out. It's called Don't Start the Revolution Without Me, and I love this book. It is such a great insight into you and into the modern history of this country.
Well, thank you. You know, I wanted to write it in a little different method than most of the political books, so I actually take you on a trip with me all the way down to the tip of the Baja, which is where I live now 6 months out of the year.
Yeah, one of your last chapters is musing on the future in the Baja, and you talk about your thoughts about how this country should be reinvented. Let's just, you know, go through the book. There's a few pages here that I flagged that I wanted to talk to you about, if you don't mind.
Sure, go ahead. You lead, I'll follow.
Okay, on page 67, you say, I knew that Bush had a good sense of humor, but my first inclination that he was not a man of his word came at that same governor's meeting earlier in 2001. And you're talking about this governor's meeting, and when you came to realize that George Bush was not a guy that you could trust.
Well, because he told us, of course, at the NGA meetings, you have dinner and dance at the White House on Sunday night, and then Monday morning, all the governors go to the White House, and then it gets down to business, where the president talks about his domestic policy and gets feedback back and forth. And Bush stated he was going to be an old federalist type of president, which I applaud, because I'm a great believer in power to the states, because that way you can pick the state to live in that most fits your personal viewpoints and all that. And he said he was going to allow the states to have great leeway, and he did just the opposite. I mean, what is it now? 13 or 14 states have passed the use of medicinal marijuana where doctors can prescribe it, yet the federal government comes down with the heavy hand and says anyone that does it will be locked up and put in jail. Oregon has what I call dignity in death, where two times, not once but twice, they have voted upon the ability to someone, if you're dying of a terminal disease, that you can take dignity in death and not, you know, live out of tubes, and which will run your finances down to nothing and you leave nothing for your children.
Yep. Yeah. Here in Oregon, the death with dignity law is as you say, two times the citizens have voted for this thing and passed it. And it is law. If you can get two doctors to certify that you have less than 6 months to live, they will give you an overdose of barbiturates, which you can take, and you just quietly go to sleep and never wake up.
And what's the matter with that? It's your choice. It's your
That's
life.
Right. That's right. And in fact, what's interesting here in Oregon is that I'm broadcasting from Portland, is that when they've done the studies on this thing, they found that the people who get the drugs, who get the prescriptions for the life-ending drugs, are less likely to commit suicide than people who don't. What happens is people are still committing suicide with terminal diseases. It's just that they're doing it with things like shotguns. I mean, they're doing it in god-awful, horrific, messy, and very often incredibly painful ways. And oddly enough, if somebody has one of these prescriptions sitting next to the bed and their terminal, every day they look at it and they think, I can last one more day. And they tend to last a lot longer and they tend to be less likely to commit suicide.
Well, in fact, one of my heroes that I met in life, Hunter S. Thompson, took his life in a violent way.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. And I think that, you know, had he had death with dignity, he would have gone for it. Yeah. Also in your book, in page 109, you talk about Otto Reich coming out and when you went to Cuba, coming out and saying that you guys were going down there to sample a sex trade, and you demanded an apology from George Bush. But also while you were in Cuba, Fidel Castro said something to you about the Kennedy assassination. I'd like your thoughts on both of those.
Well, first of all, Mr. Reich, I thought, was completely out of line. I mean, we were going down there on a trade and humanitarian reasons, and because the Bush administration didn't want me or the people going to Cuba because, you know, our government today likes us to live in ignorance rather than to become knowledgeable about things. And he made the statement that I hope they don't sample the sex trade down there, and I was completely offended and felt that all the businessmen and people going with me deserved an apology, which, of course, we never got. And second, when I came back, I made the statement then that, you know, we were down there for a week, and I never saw this sex trade industry. Perhaps when I go back again, Mr. Reich will accompany me because clearly he has some experience.
Well, him and Tom DeLay going to Saipan, right? I mean,
yeah. Well, and the point being is that, you know, I just thought, well, how out of line can they possibly be on this, you know, that we would go down there with those types of purposes, you know? Yeah. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, but then Castro told you that he didn't think that JFK could have been shot by Lee Oswald, or
no,
at least alone.
Castro first told me, the way it went down, I had 1 hour with Fidel Castro, and of course he was very perceptive when I was there because I glanced at my watch with 20 minutes to go, and he right away said, I'm sorry, am I keeping you from something? And I looked and said, no. I said, but I realize I only have an hour, and I said, I would like to ask you a personal question, and there's only 20 minutes left. And he said, ask me anything you want. And so I went into the scenario about the assassination of President Kennedy and how many of the people think that there was some involvement of Cuba. And I asked what his perception was on it, and I couldn't shut him up for 20 minutes. And he talked about how, first of all, Oswald could not make the shot. Second of all, he said it was done internally because he said the Russians at the time, who he was very close to, said about President Kennedy, they said, you can talk to this man. Mm-hmm. And Castro then said, third, he looked me right in the eye and he said, do I look suicidal? He said, if I would have killed President Kennedy, Cuba would have been wiped off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm not suicidal and I love my country. Yeah. And I believe him.
Yeah, I think he's absolutely right. And then, you know, just to carry the Castro story a little farther, on page 121, you talk about how Castro offered during Hurricane Katrina to George Bush, because he's exporting doctors all over the world. He's got
right.
So many medical schools down there. It's, you know, it's anybody who wants to become a physician can for free. And so he's got a lot of doctors, and he offered to send doctors to New Orleans and you know, the whole region that was devastated by the hurricanes after Katrina, and Bush turned him down.
Which I think is unbelievable that we would do something like that, let politics interfere with a national disaster. When national disasters happen, politics should go out the window. It's called survival. And if Fidel Castro wanted to send physicians to down to New Orleans, we should have welcomed them with open arms with the humanitarian effort. So what if he gets some publicity on it? Big deal.
Yeah.
The end result was you would have had those people there to help people who need it. And certainly Cuba's probably been hit by more hurricanes than we have, so they would have great experience in that particular situation.
Yeah, they get this thing down. We're talking with former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura. His new book, Don't Start the Revolution Without Me. On page 242, you talk about, you say, I don't know how much of a factor the Iraq war was in MSNBC's getting rid of me. Maybe they'd hired me thinking that as a Navy SEAL and Vietnam vet, I was probably a right-winger who would automatically be for the war. I wasn't. I opposed it from the beginning. You talk about Ashley Banfield, Phil Donahue getting fired from MSNBC for speaking out against the war. And elsewhere in the book, you suggest that these networks are not even news networks, that they're infotainment networks.
Well, they are. I think our entire news system today is in the entertainment business, and it all dates back, unfortunately, to 60 Minutes. Now, 60 Minutes was a great show, but the reason that it was horrible to news was that in the past, the news people or the stations and the media used to write the news off as a money loss.
Yeah.
It was required. They needed to do it to inform the public. They'd take the loss, and they'd make it up in other entertainment areas.
Well, that was required by law until Reagan stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine in 87. That was,
okay.
That was part of the Fairness Doctrine.
Okay. Well, anyway, 60 Minutes, all of a sudden, here's 60 Minutes, and believe me, they do great investigating reporting. That's not the part that I'm knocking, but what happened was they made money. They made the top 10, and well, boom, the light goes off then. The bean counters sit and think, oh, you mean we could make money off the news? And that it is at that point that news became entertainment. They're no longer into reporting the news. They're now into creating it. Case in point, last year, one whole month, every news station in America covered what? The death of Anna Nicole Smith.
Right. Then this is news?
On.
Yeah, I
absolutely
agree.
She's a Playboy playmate who happens to be a gold digger, and she deserves a month of coverage because she dies from a prescription drug overdose.
Yeah. Governor, we have about 30 seconds left. You wrap up the book talking about how whoever is elected president is going to have a heck of a job cleaning up the mess of the Bush administration.
That's correct, because I think whoever does become president, well, not so much if McCain does. He'll just continue on with business as usual over there.
Create more of a mess.
But you know, don't let the Democrats off the hook either. The Democrats voted for the war. The Democrats voted for the Patriot Act. So they're just as guilty. And why did they do it? For political reasons. They're spineless. They didn't stand up on their own.
Well, actually, in the House of Representatives, you know, the majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives did not vote for the war. That was just in the Senate. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. New York Times bestselling author and former governor of Minnesota, Jesse Ventura. His book, Don't Start the Revolution Without Me. Governor, thanks so much for being with us
today. Thank you very much. My pleasure. Have a great day.
Keep up the great work and tell the truth. 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone. The Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by the Teamsters Union, holding Waste Management Incorporated accountable in the fight for worker safety. Find out more at teamster.org. 22 minutes past the hour, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Barbara in Corrales, New Mexico. Am I pronouncing that right, Barbara?
Yes, you're doing fine.
Well, thank you. Welcome to the program, and thank you for your patience in waiting. What's up?
Well, it was a long time.
It was.
Well, I decided I was the alpha and omega of your program. I wanted to talk about John McCain.
Uh-huh, which is where we started.
Which was where you started. It's been so long I forgot now, but anyway.
John McCain and reproductive choice, I think, is what you had mentioned to Lauren.
Right, yeah, that's what I was going to do. John, no one has mentioned that John McCain is against pro-choice.
Right, or what he said is that he will, essentially, I mean, he's in code, he has said he will put anti-abortion folks on the Supreme Court if he becomes president. And the next president, in all probability, is going to appoint at least one and maybe even two or three members of the Supreme Court.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Why don't people talk about that?
Well, I've talked about it a number of times, and I'll continue to. I think by and large, though, the media has just given him an incredible pass. You know, Dan Abrams over at MSNBC, he's been doing this segment every night on his show. He calls it Teflon John, and every day it's like John McCain does or says something that if Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton had done it, it would be this big story in the news about how they'd screwed up and they put their foot in their mouth and they lied or they, you know, whatever. And McCain does it and everybody ignores it. And you're absolutely right. Barbara, I got to move along, but thank you for the call and thanks for bringing that out. George in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, George, what's up?
Well, you know, it really amazes me every time the Republicans or some conservatives says that they're a party of new ideas, and the Democrats have no new ideas, and they kept resurrecting, like, the trickle theory, which caused the Depression, or Calvin Coolidge, who started that.
Yep.
You know, Ronald Reagan resurrected that, and they want to privatize Social Security, and that's a failure. It's already been proven, and I think the main thing is that to eliminate the corporations from paying their half of the Social Security once they privatize it, and also they won't have to pay the money back they borrowed from the trust fund.
Yeah, yeah, you're right on all points, George. Right on all points. And Argentina and the United Kingdom have seen the kind of disaster that comes when you privatize Social Security. Argentina, in particular, I mean, it just totally whacked that country. AC in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Hey, AC, what's on your mind today?
I would like to discuss communist Cuba has invited communist China to drill for oil between Cuba and Florida. And there's only a stretch of 75 miles of waterway. And on the ocean floor in that area, there is no separation, or the oil is not in a container which says Cuba's oil and the United States oil. And if communist China comes to drill there and causes a spillage, that spillage will end up on a shoreline of Florida.
Right,
today,
and all the way up the East Coast, because that's the way the it's not the jet stream. What is that current called that goes
well,
up?
Today I called my senators to ask them how they can stop communist China from coming to drill there. First of all, I want them to pass immediately legislation that gives American oil drilling companies specific rights to immediately start drilling between Florida and Cuba.
So you don't mind if there's an oil spill, just so long as it's our oil spill and not China's oil spill.
Because I know American oil companies will do the utmost not to have an oil spill. But
yeah,
communist China may intentionally cause an oil spill.
Yeah, AC, I'm sorry. At $100 a barrel, I'm not buying it. I don't think anybody is going to intentionally spill oil at $100 a barrel. But, you know, your concerns are noted. And Deborah in Beaverton, Oregon. Hey, Deborah, what's up?
Hi. Sorry.
Speaking of oil, right? That's quite all right.
First-time caller, and I want to say something real quick. Thank you very much for being, you and America being a very bright lantern in the very dark room of network news.
Well, thank you.
Anyway,
Barbara, can you hold the line for just a minute? I had a break coming up there, and I didn't realize it was coming. I missed it. I'm going to put you on hold, and we'll pick up your conversation on the other end of this break. But we've got to take a break here at the bottom of the hour. 27 minutes past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program right here on Air America. TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, our telephone number 866-303-2270.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Arrogance is a deadly brew, deception and denial too. Stir in fear for heaven's sake. Cook up a war, just shake and bake. Don't it look, don't it smell like snake oil? Yes, sirree, it's snake oil. Secret plans, plain disguise, won't last forever.
Let's get them out. Well, there's still time. And pour out that snake. I say pour.
Yes, pour out that snake oil that John McCain is trying to sell us. 34 minutes past the hour. Strange news out there. This, with the tip of the hat to a listener who forwarded this from the internets. The George W. Bush Presidential Library, now in the planning stages. You'll be the first, you'll want to be the first to make a contribution to this great man's legacy. The library will include the Hurricane Katrina Room, which is still under construction. The Alberto Gonzalez Room, where you can attend a burning of the Constitution. The Texas Air National Guard Room, where you don't even have to show up. The Walter Reed Hospital Room, where they won't let you in. The Guantanamo Bay Room, where they won't let you out. The Weapons of Mass Destruction Room, which no one has been able to find. The Iraq War Room, after you complete your first tour, they make you go back for second, third, fourth, and sometimes fifth tours. The Dick Cheney Room, in the famous undisclosed location, complete with shooting gallery. Plans also include the K Street Project gift shop, where you can buy or just steal an election. The Airport Men's Room, where you can meet some of your favorite Republican senators. And last but not least, an entire floor devoted to a 7th-8th scale model of the president's ego. Yeah. When asked, President Bush said he didn't care so much about the individual exhibits as long as his museum was bigger than his father's. Deborah in Beaverton, Oregon. We were talking and we were so rudely interrupted by necessities of network radio. Hey, Deborah, what's up?
I understand. Basically, the reason that I'm calling is because I appreciate the education that I've gotten from listening to Air America, but at the same time, the reason that I'm calling is about the current conversation that's going on in Washington with Congress because of the oil companies.
Yeah, you're talking about the hearings that were held yesterday where the they said, you know, why are we giving you guys tens of billions of dollars in free money if you're making hundreds of billions of dollars in profits?
Right. Well, explain this to me because, I mean, I used to do books for a living in a previous company that I owned with my ex-husband. Profits are called profits because that's what they are after the bills are paid. Correct?
That's right. It's the money that's left over. And oil companies can take money out of profits, in other words, before profit money, and set it aside for future drilling and things like that. It's sort of the reverse of depreciation. I mean, it is possible to have reserves that are not considered profit.
Okay, so if you take $123 billion and you deduct the $18 billion that they want to keep in tax credits,
right,
they've still got a whole lot of money left over, and yet our gas prices are raising exponentially.
Yep, yep.
The two do not go together.
No, welcome to the wonders of Republican economics.
Well, I have one more comment that I need to make, and that's only because of previous President Clinton being up here recently. I am getting very tired of listening to the rhetoric of what a great president that Hillary would be, and I'm not talking about it because of my choices, but what a great president she would be, and we get a comment or two from those that are exiting the melee of the Yahoo party, and then I hear three or four sentences about how wonderful it'll be to have Bill back in the White House and so forth and so on. I would like America to snap to the idea that if she gets elected, she's president. This is not a two-for-one purchase.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, good point, Deborah, and well taken. And frankly, I think that she has the potential to be a Franklin Roosevelt president, as I think Barack Obama has the potential to be a Franklin Roosevelt president, a true agent of change who really will bring this country back to its senses. And I don't think she needs Bill to do it. And there are days when I look at the Bill Clinton show and think maybe this guy's doing more harm than good for his wife's campaign. Jeff, thank you for the call. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
Just wanted to give props to Jesse Ventura. He wasn't always my favorite, but he definitely won me over today. I just love the idea of a governor going to Cuba. And then when he realizes he's just got a few minutes left, he wants to talk about the Kennedy assassination. I think that's awesome.
Jesse Ventura is such a straight shooter. I mean, he is virtually the definition of, you know, what you see is what you get. And, great guy.
He didn't mention it, but I wonder if he asked if Castro thinks his former girlfriend had anything to do with it. since she was implicated in one of the books I read a few years back.
Yeah, you're talking about
click that,
Judith X. Yeah, I don't know what his conversation was beyond that. I mean, he briefly references it in the book, and he says he couldn't get Castro to shut up. It must have been a fascinating time. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Reddy in California. Hey, Reddy, what's up?
Tom?
Yeah.
Okay. Look, I want to take issue with you and Sam Harris. And with Sam Harris, I'm saying that he's off the mark because he believes that killing believers eradicates religious problems. And I say that killing the terrorist ideology in those religions is more to the mark.
I agree.
After all, terrorists are misguided religious believers. And you take away the ideology, you take away their killing.
Yeah, and in fact, I would suggest to you, Reddy, that the terrorist component of it is really more the political end of it than the religious end of it. It's the we want power, we feel disempowered, we don't want our country occupied, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The British, let's keep in mind, referred to the Americans in 1776 as terrorists.
Okay, and now I want to take issue with you. You stated that Islam's terror is really a fringe movement that was exacerbated by Bush's actions.
That's my understanding from friends of mine who are Muslim and from my observations, yeah.
Okay, but that ignores the fact that, you know, from its inception, Islam terrorized its neighborhoods. You know, it went into Africa, Egypt, converted the people there forcibly. And it converted all the way to India, and in not one single instance was it through peace.
And you could argue, if you read the book of Joshua, that was also the history of Judaism. And you can argue that if you look at the history of Christianity, that was, I mean, you know, the Catholic Church controlled two-thirds of Europe as late as the middle part of the 19th century. So I would say that all of these religions went through those phases, and yet Judaism and Christianity have come to modernity, and Islam is, in many places, in many cases, sliding backwards into this 10th century mentality, in large part because they believe themselves to be under attack and being besieged, in large part because in some cases they are. I mean, you've got, you know, demagogues like George Bush talking about axis of evil and Islamo-fascism and stuff.
And I would add that it's mostly the monotheistic religions that have been so violent. You know, pagan religions have not been that violent.
Tell that to the European, the tribal Europeans 3,000 years ago who were facing the Celts as they swept across Europe and organized Europe into trading.
But they were not out to establish a god in those instances.
Well, we don't know. We don't know.
Okay.
I mean, you know,
you've
got leftover, sacrificial places in England. I've been to them. You know, and they were polytheistic, presumably, and what is referred to as pagan. But yeah, you know, your point of monotheism is an interesting one, Reddy. And thank you for the call. Leonard Schlein wrote a brilliant book called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess. And it's not specific to monotheism, but his point was, or he's trying to address this issue that has been so well addressed, frankly, by a number of people, but he did a particularly good job of it, asking the question: why is it that religions that some religions seem to be associated with violence, with patriarchy, and with hierarchy? And he suggested that it has to do with teaching children an abstract alphabet before the age of seven, that it changes the way the brain is formed, and it causes the left hemisphere to become dominant. And so learning abstractions at an early age causes abstract thinking, causes a disconnection from emotions. And his example, one of his best examples, I thought, was Middle Ages Europe in the 12th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th centuries of Europe, 14th century of Europe, when everybody was illiterate, the only people who were literate were the priests. The main object of worship was the goddess. It was Mary. I mean, there were churches and shrines to Mary all over the place. And within one generation of widespread literacy across Europe, over a million women had been put to death as witches. It was just like this giant switch got flipped. And so I find it, frankly, a fascinating topic just all the way around. Fernando, but for another time. Fernando in L.A., listening on K-Talk. Hey, Fernando, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Pleasure to talk to you. Got a quick question. What happened yesterday with the oil executives? What happens now? I mean,
nothing.
Absolutely nothing. So it's all,
The Republicans will obstruct any attempt to do anything to them, and the Democrats realize that they've got an election coming up. They can grandstand with this, but they really can't do anything with it. I don't think anything's going to come out of this at all.
So this is like a little joke. It's like a little game that they play just to appease the crowds.
Well, I mean, if you want to be real cynical about it, I'd say it's more both sides trying to be on the record about their position relative to the oil companies. So if the Democrats get political power in this year, 2008, then you can see the road they're going to go down. And if the Republicans and John McCain win and they get political power, you can see the road that they're going to go down. And this is a way of kind of highlighting the issues, in my opinion. But to think that meaningful legislation is going to come out of this, or an end to the oil subsidies or something like that, I don't think there's a chance. By the way, this is interesting. New public policy polling of Barack Obama ahead in Pennsylvania. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Tell him, Leonard Cohen, a good Canadian, telling us that democracy is coming to the U.S., and a fine thing it is. We can use all the democracy we can get. You know, it is so easy to criticize folks for what's going wrong. But when things go right, I think it's really important to acknowledge it, and I would like to say congratulations to General Motors. General Motors is calling on the energy industry and governments to step up and help automakers make volume production of fuel cell electric vehicles a reality by opening more hydrogen fueling stations. And to that point, we have with us Bob Babick, the Director of Vehicle Emissions Issues for General Motors. Hey, Bob.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great. Tell us about this initiative, and Larry Burns, your Vice President for Research and Development, giving a keynote address at the National Hydrogen Association's annual convention in Sacramento, calling for more hydrogen fueling stations. Tell us about this.
Well, you know, Tom, at GM, as you mentioned, one of the challenges facing the industry is, our product's dependence on petroleum. We see that there's a need for alternatives, and one of the alternatives we're working on is fuel cell technology with putting that in vehicles. It's a great technology, and the fact that you run on hydrogen and you emit only water, so it's good for the environment. We're currently placing 100 vehicles under our Chevy Project Driveway program this year with consumers. And one of the things we want to do is get consumers to give us real-world feedback on those vehicles and their experience. One of the challenges that we see is that as we move more and more vehicles into consumers' hands, we need to make sure consumers have readily available access to hydrogen in the infrastructure, and to do so in a way that they kind of look at it as a regular retail experience. So those are the challenges we're working on, and Dr. Larry Burns was out here today at the National Hydrogen Association highlighting those issues to government and our energy friends.
Here in Portland, Oregon, we have a number of biodiesel companies. I mean, this is sort of the biodiesel epicenter of the Pacific Northwest. And one of the problems that they're having is that the gas stations, which are owned by the big oil companies, refuse to put in biodiesel pumps. And, there's discussion about having the city or the state legislate that they must, forcing them to, because they're basically saying, no, even if there's a demand, we're not going to do it because it competes with our product. Are you getting pushback from the oil industry on this?
What we're seeing right now is that the both government and the energy industry has worked with us well. And, you know, currently in California, there's about 25 hydrogen stations. We also have infrastructure in Washington and New York. But what we're asking for now is more of a sense of urgency or more of a collective will to kind of move to the next step. As I say, a lot of these stations, they're at fleet locations such as a transit agency. They might be found like at a facility behind a fence, might have limited hours of operation. But as we're putting these vehicles in the real consumers' hands, those folks want a real life experience, you know, that regular retail experience where they can pull up to the station at any given time and get hydrogen. And so that's kind of what we're reaching out to these partners of ours and asking them to, you know, to move with us into the future and help make this a reality.
Well, I think it's just great that you're doing it, Bob, and thanks for coming on the program and sharing the story with us.
Oh, no problem, Tom. I appreciate you having me on.
Great talking with you. Bob Babick, he's the Director of Vehicle Emissions Issues for General Motors. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Lucille in Colorado, listening on KKZN. Hey, Lucille, what's up?
Hey, I've been fascinated with all your conversations with various people, and now I don't think it's so important to talk about what I wanted to talk about, which was atheism.
Uh-huh.
I'm a sincere atheist, and I subscribe to two magazines called the they're both Inquirer-type magazines, and they are so serious, and they're so honest and dedicated, and they're not evangelizing at all. And, you know, we can thank the evangelicals for George Bush, and I really think he's destroying this country. But on politics, I'm rabid, so I won't talk about that. I'm more sane.
Well, let me ask you a question. You know, Dan Quinn, in I believe it's his second Ishmael book, but maybe it's the story of B, he raises the question, why would a religious person need to go back and read the Bible over and over and over again? And, you know, my answer to the question is, it feels good. And I'm wondering why, if you're already certain that you're an atheist, you need to revisit the literature of atheism over and over and over again.
I don't revisit the literature.
Well, you get these magazines every month.
Oh, they help me clarify a lot of things. Atheists have very little rights in this country. The religious people think that, and I live in a small community in Colorado, and it has more churches than anything else, which is the only thing that ever caused it to be in the Guinness Book of Records. And,
well, that's interesting.
You know, I'm overcome with religion, and they just don't understand that you can be happy without that. And I had written a note of condolence on the death of my daughter-in-law, and her daughters were all at her funeral, and one daughter wrote me a note that said, she's up in heaven watching over us. Listen, if she's up in the heavens, I hope somebody's told the space explorers to watch out for her when they're up there.
No, I got it, Lucille. We're out of time, but thank you for the call and a thoughtful conversation. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be confronting Mark Morano, Senator James Inhofe's staff, about global warming. He claims the media is ignoring the record growth of ice in the Arctic. Steve Alton, the author of the book Paul Craig Roberts, says every American should read, stops by to tell us about his new book, The Shell Game. It's all about oil and the world is running out. And, of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.